One of the benefits of studying the Megillah is that it gives us a very deep insight into the character of people, how people behave in different situations. It gives you an insight into the emotional life, the psychic life of different types of people. Essentially, there's a distinction made between what we would call the tzaddik, the righteous people, and the Rasha, the wicked person. The wicked person doesn't necessarily mean, as in today's society, a wicked person is generally regarded evil. For example, Bush always uses this to describe bin Laden or Saddam Hussein, which is correct. But the term evil in our society essentially has to do with people that destroy others, with murderous people. That's certainly true. But when we use the term, it's not only with regard to that aspect. It's a wicked person is someone who's not living in accordance with the truth. Someone who's living an instinctual kind of an existence. So it's evil or it's wicked from the standpoint of the purpose of human life. The way people use the term evil today, it's not based upon the underlying cause of what it is that would render a certain type of an existence to be evil. They're only fixated on a result. So they don't really care as to the cause, and the result, of course, that troubles the most is the destruction of other people, which is true. That's a very significant phenomenon. However, the understanding of evil should not just be on that the superficial basis. One should seek to go beyond that, beneath that, so to speak. So we have different characters on the side of those whom we would describe as Rishayim. Essentially, you have Haman and Ahasuerus. And part of our understanding of the Megillah is to try and differentiate between them. On the other side, of course, you have the Derech of the Tzaddikim. They live according to a different Derech. And the Navi that speaks about the Derech says, V'derech Rishayim Toved. The way of life, the approach of the Rasha, is one which leads to destruction. And there's a different derech, the derech of the tzaddik. And that's one that leads to success. This is illustrated to a great extent in the Megillah. I just want to illustrate that with one particular incident. Of course, the main Rasha in the story is Haman. And Haman was someone who sought to magnify himself, to elevate himself. That's what rendered him into what was considered to be an idolatrous entity. So idolatry doesn't necessarily have to be a statue, some physical object that people bow down to, or some force that they're connected to, which they elevate to the status of being a deity. It could even be a human being, which is that's a very significant, the deification of man. That exactly was what Haman represented, and that was the idea of everybody bowing down to him. Of course, you know that Mordechai refused. Now you see his reaction to the refusal of Mordechai. When he first became aware of it, that's in chapter 3 in Esther, the book of Esther. So it describes the fact that Mordechai refused to bow, and the servants of the king confronted Mordechai, and apparently they tried to pressure him into going along. He refused, and finally he was told to Haman. Then it describes the reaction of Haman. Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai korei umishtachav alo. Haman saw that Mordechai did not kneel or bow to him. Vayimalei Haman chema, and he was filled with anger. This is a very important theme, the role of anger in the life of the Russia and how it contributes to their downfall. It's a very significant element. And I'll show you how it works throughout the entire Megillah. However, you see his reaction. It was a purely emotional reaction. He couldn't tolerate it, couldn't accept it. Which, of course, raises a question, which I may not be answering right now, but I'm just trying to also at this point out some of the questions. As a person studies the Megillah, they should take note of the questions. Is this a normal kind of a reaction? One could ask, even if he's an egomaniac, and even if his desire is for honor and for everybody to acknowledge him, still, why should this one refusal create such a problem for him? After all, as far as we know, the only person that didn't comply was Mordechai. Everybody else complied. So why would it create such a fury within him and cause him to take such extreme measures? After all, his solution to this was genocide, wipe out an entire people. All right, I just want you to think about that question, but we'll move on. We'll take that for granted at this point. So he was filled with rage. But essentially, the whole basis for the decision was rage. That's all it was. Then, of course, it tells you that it seemed too petty to just deal with Mordechai because they told him about the nation. So this led to a very severe hatred against the nation that he came from. And he sought to destroy all the Jews. So this triggered off a tremendous feeling, a tremendous surge of anti-Semitism within him. I wouldn't say that he was necessarily favorable to the Jews before this. We don't know how he felt before this. I don't think he was a lover of the Jews. But apparently he never had any real pretext or any real cause to take such an extreme attitude of hostility to the Jews. This was the trigger. And he sought then to just destroy all the Jews, to wipe out all the Jews. Couldn't tolerate their existence. Now, the next phase describes what he did. And his genius was that he was able to camouflage his real emotions, his intentions, and to present it to the king. He had to win over the king. And he was able to do so by what seemed to be a rational argument, that the Jews represent a fifth column, that they represent the danger, that they don't blend in, they're not loyal, they don't pay their taxes, and so on and so forth. It sounds very familiar, very similar to what Paro argued, that the Jews represent a group that's distinct. Well, Paro said that they'll join with our enemies. Haman over here seems to be echoing the same type of a theme. Of course, he doesn't mention anything about the personal slight. Anyways, he's able to deal to be successful. He's successful in getting the king to agree. So this is a tremendous political achievement within the framework of Haman. That is, the decree was sealed. He gets the king to agree to this. This is not a small thing, by the way. You have to realize genocide, the annihilation of a significant population which is dispersed throughout the entire empire, is a very significant thing. He gets the king to agree to that, and they set aside the money, and the king gives him complete seal of approval. You see how serious it is, because then they then proceed to send out messengers to all the different provinces. And it describes what happened when the messages arrived and the Jews found out about it. They, except in Shushan. Shushan was different, but throughout the entire empire, wherever the Jews found out about it, there was tremendous suffering and grief wailing because they understood the full implications. Now, that concludes the description of the formulation of the edict. Concludes at the end of chapter 3 on Tezvav, which is 15. Haratzim Yatzu Dchufim Midvar Melech. The couriers ran out under pressure to, at the king's command, to spread the word. He had thus nitna b'Shushan Abira, and the law was established in Shushan. That is, that everybody should be prepared for that day in Adar for the destruction of the Jews. V'amelech v'Haman yashru lishtos, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. Interesting, it tells you their reaction to this. This was cause for celebration. The city of Shushan was confused. And I'm not going to take up that issue right now, because it describes, you can see a contrast between the reaction in Shushan and the reaction of the Jews. When it says the city of Shushan was confused, Rashi makes it clear, Hayehudim Shabbat, the Jews were confused. However, this is not the case in the other provinces where the decree had arrived. Uvachal Medina, that's described in Dalet Gimel. Uvachal Medina, Medina, in all of the different provinces. Makom asher dvar melech v'dasa magia, any place where the word of the king and the law arrived. Evel gadol leYehudim, there was tremendous mourning. Tzom uvachiyu mispeid, fasting, crying, hesped, sak ve'efer, a sackcloth and ashes were donned by the multitude. So you see that outside of Shushan, it wasn't Navocha. They were very, very clear as to the full significance. There was no self-delusion about it. However, it would seem that at least for the moment, Haman had solved his problem. And we all know what the problem was. The problem was that he simply couldn't tolerate. His emotions couldn't tolerate the fact that Mordechai would not bow down to him. And once he had found a solution to the problem, so it seems he was okay. Now he was fine. He felt good. The Amelech Lahaman Yashru Lishtos. They sat down to drink. Now if that's the case, let's fast forward now. This is after Mordechai has interceded with Esther. That's another story, the story of Esther and Mordechai's intercession, and how at first she's reluctant, and then he gives her a very stinging type of rebuke, and finally she accepts. And then she declares the fast, the three-day fast, and she launches her own strategy. That was her idea. And that's something that we have to study. What was the idea behind it? The strategy of the party and inviting Haman and the king, and then refusing to state what she wanted the first night and delaying it for a second night. What was the idea behind that? All right, that's something that I plan to take up this Wednesday night. But let's just take, we're studying now emotional reaction. What happens at that party? So that's in chapter 5, where she appears suddenly uninvited before the king, and he stretches out the scepter, which means that he accepts her appointment, that she can come in, and she makes a request. Then they come to the party. And then at the party, he asks what her request is, and he even offers up to half the kingdom. And we know her response, and that is to say that if I found favor in your eyes, so then please come tomorrow night. And tomorrow night I'll tell you what it is that I really want. Now, take a look at Tess. Vayetze Haman Vayomahu, Sameach V'tov Lev. And Haman went out on that day happy. He was in great spirits. And there's no question that this was the greatest day of his life. He describes that later on. Later on, when he gathers together with his advisors, he describes all of his achievements and his glory. And he mentions that the king, the queen, didn't invite anybody to the party except me, the Gamlamachar. And also, tomorrow, I'm invited to be with her and the king. Now, what happens? So he's in a great state of joy for a moment. He experiences this great joy, Sameach v'tov lev, and we understand why, because this is what he's been struggling for, this type of recognition, this type of prestige. But then it says, V'cheros Haman es Mardechai b'shar ha-melech, when Haman saw Mardechai in the gate of the king, v'lo kam v'lo zami menu, and he didn't stand, nor did he move because of him, v'yimalei Haman al Mardechai chema. And Haman was filled with rage against Mardechai. Vayisapak Haman. He had to really restrain himself. He had to control himself. Vayavo el beso, to get to his house. He could barely make it. And then he sent and he had to bring his friends and his advisors and discuss it. So this is a very significant development in the story. Because this, at this point in time, this is the beginning of the end, actually, of Haman. Because from this point on, Haman is now under the complete control of his emotion. His emotion of hate, his emotion of anger, and you could see he's just falling now. From one downfall to the next. He's like being swept along by some tide, and he can't regroup, he can't gather his forces, he can't fight off this anger. And this is a very significant element. Everything that happens from this point on, all the pieces are being put into place for the salvation of the Jews and the destruction of Haman. However, it seems to me that there's something here that doesn't make sense on a psychological level, and that we should raise a question. What caused Haman to get so upset now? The fact that Mordechai didn't bow down to him, that was nothing new. We understand the first time it occurred, when Haman didn't realize it, and Haman was demanding that everybody acknowledge him, and then he found out that there was somebody that was defying him, and then he saw it, so that we understand. Although we could raise a question on that, I raised the question, so why couldn't he take it in stride? Why did it have such significance? But let's put that aside. Because let's say his emotions couldn't bear that anybody would defy that. That was so important to him. So he had a problem. But you see, he behaved differently over there. That is, he recognized that there was a problem, but he was able to put aside his emotion, and he thought it over. And he didn't allow his emotion to dictate the solution. He came up with a very formidable solution, and that is not to take action against Mordechai alone, to take action against the entire people, and he was able to formulate a strategy for convincing the king to go along with him. So he had everything under control. Now, are we to assume that once the decision was reached, that every time he saw Mordechai, he'd have the same reaction of rage? It doesn't make sense. First of all, it says, V'hamelech v'haman yashru lishtos. That is, even though Mordechai was still there, and even though Mordechai didn't bow down to him, but that shouldn't bother him anymore. I would assume it didn't bother him. It's like, because now it's different. When somebody is doing something that annoys you, for example, you may have a student that is disrespectful and undermining you and so forth, and it bothers you, and you have no way of controlling that student. Most of the time in these situations, when a teacher does feel that threatened, is because of a certain insecurity in the teacher. So certain types of people can evoke that insecurity. Most people have that kind of an insecurity. And as long as others are going along with them, that reinforces them. But then there'll always be someone who sort of questions you. You just the way they look at you, or they question you, and they're sort of saying that I know that you're nothing. You're a phony. So very often, people that are insecure can't deal with that. So let's assume that you're in a situation like that. And let's assume that you're clever, though. You can't win over the student. You can't change the student's behavior. So you go to the principal, and you can't tell the truth that the real reason you want the student out is because the student makes you feel insecure. You're not going to tell that to the principal. So if you're clever, you make up some kind of a excuse, some kind of reason, usually in the best interest of the student himself. He's very gifted. He'd be doing much better in the other class, and so on and so forth. And to the contrary, you make it appear that you're only interested in helping the student. Now, if you're good at that, and you convince the principal, so then the principal arranges that the student will be transferred to a different class. But let's say it's towards the end of the term. You still have a month to go. So the principal says that we're not going to do the thing now. Just let him stay there till the end of the term. And next term he'll be in the other class. So now, will the teacher feel the same way when the teacher goes back to the class? Seems to me that the teacher now will be fine. We'll be able to tolerate, we'll be able to deal with the student, because in the back of his mind he realizes that he solved the problem. It's just a matter of a couple of weeks, but the student's going to be gone. So therefore, the kind of reaction that was being evoked before this is gone now. Because before this, he didn't have any solution. So it just meant that you'd always be subject to this humiliation. But now that you have a solution, that's it. You can go on with your life. You can forget about it. There's no doubt in my mind that that's what happens in general, and I'm sure that's what happens with Haman. Now, to the contrary, every time he walked past the gate and he saw Mordechai, it wouldn't bother him anymore. And to the contrary, he may be laughing inwardly and say, you know, go right ahead. In a few months' time, you're going to be gone with the rest of your people. Now, if that is the case, either we assume that it's not the case and that Haman still went into a rage every time he saw Mordechai, which I don't think that's the case. And if it was the case, then he wasn't stupid. Then he was being invited to the party, and he was in a great, great mood. So then he would have made sure not to see this person that always put him in a bad mood. So I don't think that that was the case. I think that once he dealt with the problem, so that's it, it was solved. But then something strange happens. He goes to this party, and this is the apex of his career. This is the greatest moment in his life. And he leaves in a state of happiness, and it doesn't last very long. As soon as he sees Mordechai, he's filled with the same rage. So what happened? How do we explain this? This rage is very significant because it contributes in a very significant manner to what happens next. The entire story might have worked out differently were it not for this rage. Because as a result of this rage, he gathers his advisors. And they don't give him rational advice. He accepts the advice because he's in a completely irrational state. He's just being governed now by the need for immediate gratification against Mordechai, which is also very, very strange, because before he was able to control the emotion against Mordechai, they advised him to go immediately to the king. It was very, very reckless, stupid political advice to do that. And one thing leads to another. And before you know it, he's really on the path to his own destruction. We don't know what would have happened had he not gone there that night. But we do know that in the manner in which the miracle unfolded, this was a significant element. So he definitely contributes to his own downfall. All because of this. Because when he left in that state of happiness, he sees Mordechai, and he goes into a rage. And this rage he can't deal with. In order to explain this, it seems to me clear that a change occurred as a result of the party that Esther threw. and said that she invited Haman. I'm not saying that this was the essential intention of Esther. The main reason for the party was to create a sense of suspense. It was really directed primarily at Ahasuerus. And Haman was only brought in there in order to effectuate certain emotions, to prepare the emotional groundwork for the plea that she was going to make. However, whether intentionally or unintentionally, it's clear that it had a very significant emotional effect upon Haman and created a change in the balance of forces. That is to say that there are two states of the emotion. People can have very, very powerful emotions. But in general, in order to get anywhere in this world, you have to keep your emotions in check, especially in the political world, where you have powerful hatreds and rivalries. And you have to hold it in check. You can't express them. To the contrary, very often you have to appear that you like the person or the person's your friend. So that's to acknowledge that you despise this person would make you pretty ineffective in the political arena. And you see that's the way Haman operated. He didn't complain about Mordechai at all when he spoke to the king. It had nothing to do with Mordechai. He couldn't do that because then it would indicate that he was trying to manipulate the state. Everything was a means to his own glory. That he couldn't acknowledge. In the end, of course, that is what brings him down. The truth about him comes out. So then, when he saw Mordechai, it was a tremendous blow to him. And the reasons are, as Yosef said, that this answers the question of why he couldn't put it in stride. Because it just wasn't a question of applause. It wasn't a question of how many people can I get on my side. It wasn't a question of popularity. If it's popularity, so that's fine. If you have 90% popularity, that's fantastic. So the 10% don't bother you. This was something else. This was a significant distortion of reality. That is to say that he should be regarded as being a supreme. You see, that type of a mentality is very, very... it's very, very susceptible to any type of opposition. Cannot tolerate any kind of an opposition. You see that, for example, in Hitler, Yamach Shemo, the same type of a megalomaniac mentality that anyone that argued or differed with him had to be destroyed. Can't tolerate any truth, any dissent. Very fragile type of a mentality. Because, since the person has a reality principle, the person realizes that this is simply not true. And the only way that he can maintain this is through intimidation. And if you can't intimidate, if you can't force everybody to acknowledge it through intimidation, then the whole thing falls apart. And that's really the threat that the Mordechai represented. It was a psychological phenomenon that Mordechai recognized the truth. And Mordechai really evoked his own insecurities within himself, and that he couldn't deal with. That's why he went into this rage. But at that stage, he was able to deal with the situation. Because he was on the way up, and he was, when a person is working on the way up, so then he has the emotional desire. But the emotion is in a state of desire where he's going to be able to utilize all of his capacities for self-control in order to gratify the emotion. What happens in that night is that situation allowed him to, so to speak, relax and to experience that feeling of exaltation. Now the emotion was in a different state. The emotion was in a state of satisfaction, of being satisfied, and all of that repressed self-love and self-adulation, self-deification, all of that was allowed to rise to the surface. That's why he was Sameach V'Tov Lev, that his dreams had come true, and now he was luxuriating in the enjoyment of that feeling. That's a completely different thing. It would be, for example, if a person in the community who's trying to establish himself and wants to be honored and recognized, So then there are people in the community that disparage him, don't show him the respect, and so on and so forth. And he has to make it appear that it doesn't bother him. So he's able to do that. But then finally, if he has a great achievement and he's being awarded a great prize, the Nobel Prize or something else, on that night when everybody is paying tribute and he's being recognized, and then somebody insults him, that would destroy him. Because now it's a different thing. Now he's luxuriating in the enjoyment of the emotion itself. That's what happens over here. In my opinion, that in the first instance, of course he was enraged, but he controlled it, because he was still involved in the struggle and he was able to restrain himself, and he came up with a plan which made a lot of sense from his point of view and was successful in implementing it. At that point in time, he was able to deal with the emotion. Then I would say it might have bothered him, but it didn't have that impact upon him. If he were to see Mordechai, it would not put him in a state of rage, because he knew that Mordechai is not a problem. I've dealt with him. What happened was something completely unexpected. He wasn't prepared for this. And again, I'm not saying that this was the primary aim of Esther. We don't know exactly all of the thoughts that went into our plan. I think we can work out the plan in retrospect in general terms. It was a good plan, but it had this effect as well. It had a significant effect upon Haman in terms of lulling him into a false state of complacency, but more than complacency, of supremacy. He was luxuriating in his feeling of supremacy, and he wasn't prepared for that, and therefore in that state, when he was enjoying it, it's kind of like you can imagine that a dog is hungry, been waiting all day, and the master throws him a bone, and he's you can see that that lust with which the dog goes after the bone, and then somebody tries to pull the bone out of his mouth. It could be even his own master, and he'll bite him. That's the normally he'd have fear of the master and respect, but not in this situation. That's the situation that he was put into. And when he saw Mordechai, v'lo kam, and he didn't rise, v'lo zomimenu. V'lo zomimenu is very, very significant. Because you could ask, why do I care that he didn't move? V'lo zah. V'lo zah means that he didn't even recognize his existence, that there's anything here. It's like there's nothing here. There's nothing even to move. It was the complete absence of any kind of recognition. In that state, he couldn't bear it. He destroyed it. It's like taking this meal that a person has been preparing for hours and hours and hours, or even weeks, this tremendous feast, and somebody comes along and pours gasoline all over it. That puts a person into the state of rage. And that is very, very significant, because that's the downfall of the Russia. The downfall of the Russia is the inability to control the emotions. He's propelled by certain emotions, and up to a point, if he has intelligence, he's able to utilize his intelligence, and he succeeds only to the extent that he's able to utilize the intelligence, but the intelligence is not in control. The emotion is in control. And since the emotion is in control, there'll be two phases in his life. There'll be a phase in which he'll be able to put the emotion aside, even though the emotion is propelling him, but when he decides how to get to what he wants, he puts the emotion aside and lets the mind do the work, and he's very formidable. But the downfall, the Achilles heel of the Russia, is that since essentially he's emotional, there'll be a point in time where that very emotion will destroy the reason. And you can see that in the lives of all the Rishayim throughout history. I'll try to give some further illustrations. But that, I think, is the point that's being demonstrated over here. It was that emotion of burning anger, which was brought out to the contrary by the fact that he achieves what he wanted to achieve. And in that state, he couldn't tolerate any frustration whatsoever. And there was no way he couldn't come back from that, because then one mistake leads to another. He needs immediate gratification. He can't deal with it. He has to bring his advisors. And he's vulnerable to the worst possible advice because he can't think clearly. And then they're not interested in giving rational advice. They're only interested in trying to help him deal with the immediate necessity of the emotion. And from that point on, he's like a pawn. He can't regain his bearings, and he's walking himself. He's taking the path to destruction by himself.